Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Plato from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophers. This is episode 3. After a break, I had a day off with a whole day of psychometric testing. So it was a pretty brutal day in terms of, it wasn't, the test wasn't hard, but it took a lot of time. We're doing Plato, and Plato, we find out, has sort of two main, well, besides being Greek, besides being ancient Greek from around 400 BC, was a student of Socrates. Socrates was a great man, and Plato basically, I think the equivalent of education of Plato by his stories, fictional stories. He doesn't have complete philosophical works. He has fictional stories where the characters discuss philosophy. And in a sense, the genre that we have, sort of similar to it, would be a movie. The short movie, short films. So that just popped into my head. That's one aspect. The other aspect is that Plato is really trying to kickstart philosophy. So rather than doing philosophy, he's thinking about philosophy. So the people before him, which is Tales and Pythagoras sort of, and Socrates, they actually did philosophy. He's probably thinking about the philosophy, the art of philosophy, and the role of philosophy going through. Big thing in that he has the theory of forms, which people sort of discuss, and so it's he's able to actually grapple with abstract objects by making them semi-concrete, sort of like a thing where you can walk to. It's there, mate. There's goodness and virtue is really there. But then it's not, it's a form. So a form is an idealized concept of it. And then he has a series of other sort of sub-philosophies about this ability to grasp concepts means that there must be an afterlife, a spiritual life to go across it. So what I'll do is I'll just quietly read into section 9. So we're doing a lot of small sections now, and I don't know how long I can go for reading this, either two times, either exhaustion or having to go off and pick up my daughter from tennis. Does Plato change his mind about forms? So forms is his concrete idea of an abstract. Yeah, it's like abstract was completely new to the human race, so the first mezzanine, if you like, is a concrete actualization of an abstract concept. At least that's my angle of it, at least. This is a way of reading Plato's dialogues, so these are short movies. It does not presuppose that he never changes his mind about anything, that whatever any of his main interlocutors uphold in one dialogue will continue to be presupposed, or so dialogues are like short movies, so he's like a movie projector, producer. And I wish I could remember a good Hollywood one. The only one I know is Alfred Hitchcock. But you can imagine a movie presenter. He presents a few series of movies or writing. Affirmed elsewhere without alteration. It is, in fact, a difficult and delicate matter to determine on the basis of our reading of the dialogues whether Plato meant to modify or reject one dialogue that would that he has his main interlocutor, which is usually actor, we'd say, which is usually Socrates, affirm in some other. One of the most intriguing controversial questions about his treatment of forms, for example, is whether he concedes that his conceptions of those abstract entities is vulnerable to criticism, and, if so, whether he revises some of his assumptions that he's been making about them or develops a more elaborate picture of them that allows him to respond to that criticism. And in Parmenides, and I've decided, look, I'll go and try and read it. I'm going to have to get the librarian to get these out for me, because they're just not off on the shelves. The principal interlocutor, not Socrates, he is here portrayed as a promising young philosopher in need of further training, but rather the pre-Socratic form from Ella, who gives the dialogue its names, Parmenides, that's the name of his goes. Sorry for my Australian accent. Subjects the forms to withering criticism and then consents to conduct an inquiry into the nature of oneness, and that is to avert connection of his to his critique of the forms, which is rather interesting. I think the dialogue's got a great thing because they've been theatrically arranged for communication rather than introspective thoughts like of Kant, etc. Does the discussion of oneness, a baffling series of contradictions or at any rate propositions that seem on the surface to be contradictions, in some way help address the problems raised about forms? Now, this is one of the interesting things, is that these people don't have papers or PowerPoints. They don't have the things which actually help then hinder. That's my opinion. That is one way of reading a dialogue, and if we do read it in this way, does it show that Plato has changed his mind about some ideas about forms he inserted in earlier dialogues? Can we find dialogues in which we encounter, quote, a new theory of forms, that is, a way of thinking of forms that carefully steers clear of the assumptions about the forms that led to Parmenides' critique? It's not easy to say. I don't know why you're bothering to even think about this. We cannot even raise this as an issue worth pondering unless we presuppose that behind the dogs there stands a single mind that is using these writings as a way of hitting upon the truth and of bringing that truth to the attention of others. Well, yes, you can't do that, can you? We find in Timaeus, the principal interlocutor of the dialogue is named after him, that the eclectic visitor from the sophist and the statements talking about forms in a way that is entirely consistent with the way Socrates talks about them in the forms in Perfido and Republic. But I think I'm going to have to get the Republic. Read it to you. Then there is only one reasonable explanation of the consistency. Plato believes that there is a way of talking about forms is correct, or at least strongly supported by powerful considerations. If, on the other hand, we find Timaeus and the eclectic visitors talks about forms in a way that does not harmonize in the way that Socrates conceives of those abstract objects in the dialogues that assigned him a central role as the director of conversation, then the most plausible explanation for these discrepancies is Plato has changed his mind about the nature of these entities. It would be implausible to suppose that Plato himself had no convictions about forms and merely wanted to give his readers a mental exercise in composing dialogues in which different leading characters talk about these objects in discordant ways. Okay, surprisingly, that's the end of the page. And on to episode 10, 8 minutes in. So this goes back to what I said earlier. Plato is our equivalent of dialogues would be short movies, and he writes the dialogues for them, and it's like doing an interview behind. These people are dealing with deep topics. And what forms are. So again, forms are the abstract concept, like virtue or goodness or oneness. There's that concept, and how is that linked into the physical world? It's really interesting, straddling the between the abstract and the concrete, which these Greeks were dealing with, and the idea, modern idea of mathematics. Like even in the Middle Ages, is whether the Renaissance, whether people would have mathematical duels. You know, what was that all about? I think there's another dimension about where people build their reputation as philosophers, which is not here. That I don't know. Someone gets really enamored with an idea and associates the idea with themselves, becomes famous because of the idea, which is just sort of a modern nonsense. Okay, 10. Does Plato change his mind about politics? The same point that we must view dialogues as a product of a single mind, a single philosopher, though perhaps one who changes his mind can be made in connection with the politics of Plato's works. It is noteworthy to begin with that Plato is, among other things, a political philosopher. which is interesting. Like, he's pro-slavery and anti-women. Or this Aristotle was appallingly anti-women. It's unacceptable. Aristotle would be almost a Nazi. Like, the modern people, if they really understood Aristotle, would say, like, he's a bloody Nazi. For he gives expression in several writings, particularly Phaedo, to a yearning to escape from the tawdriness of ordinary human relations. Similarly, he evinces a sense of ugliness of the sensible world, whose beauty pales in comparison to that of the forms. Because of this, it would be all too easy for Plato to turn his back entirely on the practical reality, and confine his speculations to theoretical questions. Some of his works, Parmenides, is a stellar example, do confine themselves to exploring questions that seem to have no bearing whatsoever on practical life. That's why Republic is much easier to read. This is just, swap channels. But it is remarkable how few of his works fall into this category. Even the highly abstract questions raised in the Sophists about the nature of being and not being are, after all, embedded in a search for definition of sophistry, and thus they call to mind the question of whether Socrates should be classified as a sophist, that is, someone studying knowledge, whether, in other words, sophists are to be despised and avoided. Yeah, bloody academics, we'd call them. In any case, despite the great sympathy Plato expresses for the desire to shed one bodies and to live in an incorporeal world, he devotes an enormous amount of energy to the task of understanding the world we live in, appreciating its limited beauty and improving it. Which is really interesting to the Baconian mantra. That's Francis Bacon. His tribute to the mixed beauty of the sensible world in Thomas consists of a tradition of an outcome of divine efforts to mould reality in the imagination, image of forms, and using simple geometrical patterns and harmonious arithmetic relations as building blocks. The desire to transform human relations is given expression in far greater large number of works. Socrates presents himself in Plato's Apology as a man who does not have his head in the clouds. That is part of Aristophanes' charge against him in the clouds. There you go. That's interesting. He does not want to escape from the everyday world, but to make it better. He presents himself in Gorgias as the only Athenian who has tried his hand at the true art of politics. Okay. Similarly, I'm just looking at the time for when I have to pick up my daughter. It's not raining. She's doing tennis, and if it's raining, I have to go and pick her up. Similarly, the Socrates of Republic devotes a considerable part of his discussion to a critique of ordinary social institutions, the family, private property, the rule by many. The motivation that lies behind the writing of the dialogue is the desire to transform, or in any way improve. Political life, not to escape from it, although it is acknowledged that the desire to escape is an honourable one. The best sort of rulers greatly prefer the contemplation of divine reality to the government of a city. I just interrupt there, but one of the things you can see that I can read a lot faster with my brain rested. And if we have, I'll be back later if there's an interruption now, I have to go. And if we have any further doubts that Plato does not take an interest in the practical realm, we need only to turn to the Laws, a work of such great detail and length about voting procedures, punishments, education, legislation, and oversight of public officials can only have been produced by someone who wants to contribute something to the improvement of the lives we lead in the sensible, imperfect realm. Further evidence of Plato's interest in practical matters can be drawn from his letters, if they are genuine. In most of them, he represents himself as having a deep interest in educating, with the help of a friend Dion, the ruler of Syracuse, Dionysus II, and thus reforming the city's politics. Just as any attempt to understand Plato's view about forms must confront the question whether his thoughts about them were developed or altered over time, so too our reading of him as a political philosopher must be shaped by the willingness to consider the possibility that he changed his mind. For example, on any plausible reading of Republic, Plato evinces a deep antipathy to rule by many. Socrates tells his interlocutors that the only politics that should engage them are those of anti-democratic regime he depicts as a paradigm of good, of a good constitution. And yet, in Laws, the Athenian visitor proposes a detailed legislative framework for a city in which non-philosophers, people who have never heard of the forms and have not been trained to understand them, are given considerable powers as rulers. Plato would not have invested so much time in the creation of this comprehensive and lengthy work had he not believed in the creation of a political community ruled by those who are philosophically unenlightened is a project that desires the support of his readers. That's what actually happens, that we are ruled and governed by people who are unphilosophically trained. I don't know what his view on it. Has Plato changed his mind then? Has he re-evaluated the highly negative opinion he once held of those who are innocent of philosophy? Did he at first think that the reform of the existing Greek cities with all their imperfections is a waste of time, but then decide that the endeavour was of great value? And if so, what led him to change his mind? Answers to these questions can be justified only by careful attention to what he has his interlocutors say. But it would be utterly implausible to suppose that these developmental questions it need not be raised on the grounds that the Republican Laws each has its own cast of characters and that the works therefore cannot come into contradiction with each other. According to this hypothesis, the one that must be rejected, because it is Socrates, not Plato, who is critical of democracy in the Republic, and because it is the Athenian visitor, not Plato, who recognises the merits. Of the rule by many in Laws. There is also a possibility that the two dialogues are in tension with each other. Against this hypothesis, we should say, since both the Republican Laws are works in which Plato is trying to move his reader towards certain conclusions by having them reflect on certain arguments, these dialogues are not barred from having this feature by their use of interlocutors. It would be an evasion of our responsibility as readers and students of Plato is not to ask whether what one has of them advocates is compatible with what the other advocates. If we answer that question negatively, we have some explaining to do. What led to this change? Alternatively, if we conclude that the two works are compatible, we must say why the appearance of conflict is illusory. So I really don't know whether Plato is actually saying democracy is bad, rule by many is bad, a rule by stupid people is bad, because one just labours under the ineffectualness of philosophical leaders, the effectiveness and soulness of being ruled by non-philosophical leaders. On to 11. The historical secretary, Socrates, early, middle, and late dialogues. So that's what Socrates was in reality and the early, middle, and late dialogues. So remember here, this is section 11. Remember that dialogues are basically soap operas, plays, teledramas produced by Plato, in which he injected a lot of ideas. So it's would be equivalent to our modern documentary or mini-series, reconstructive mini-series. Many contemporary scholars find it plausible that when Plato embarked on his career as a philosophical writer, he composed, in addition to his apology of Socrates, a number of short ethical dialogues that contain little or nothing in the way of positive philosophical doctrine, but are mainly devoted to portraying the way in which Socrates punctured at the pretensions of his interlocutors and force them to realize that they are unable to offer satisfactory definitions of ethical terms they used or satisfactory arguments of their moral beliefs, which is really true. One of the things is that in this hierarchy, or the hierarchy of society that exists in Australia, someone has a stupid opinion, you can't question it. There's just like three or four layers before you can get to ask someone to do it, and they can just walk away from you. Okay, according to this way of placing the dialogues into a rough chronological order associated especially with Gregory Falstow's name, I don't know who literally Velsto's name is, see especially Socrates, Ironist and moral philosopher. So Ironist, iron as in iron, the mineral, the metal. Okay, well, so we have to read Socrates, Ironist and moral philosopher. Plato, at this point of his career, was content to use his writing primarily for the purpose of preserving the memory of Socrates and making plain the superiority of his hero in intellectual skill and moral seriousness to all his contemporaries, particularly those among them who claimed to be expert on religious, political, and moral matters. Into this category of early dialogues, they are sometimes called the Socratic dialogues, possibly without any intended chronological connotation, place Charmides, Critos, Euthymedus, Hypro, Gorgias, Hippias Major, Hippias Minor, Ion, Ion, Laches, Lysis, and Protagoras. Some scholars hold that we can tell which each of these come later. During Plato's early period, it seems to me a task of word and artificial intelligence. There'd be something to do. We'd be able to pick up something with artificial intelligence. Okay. This is from computer science, applying computer science to this problem. For example, it's sometimes said that Protagoras and Gorgias are later because of their greater length and philosophical complexities. Other dialogues, for example, Charmides and Lys, are thought not to be among Plato's earliest within this early group, because in them Socrates appears to be playing a more active role in shaping the progress of the dialogue, that is, he has more ideas of his own. In comparison with many of Plato's other dialogues, see, these, quote, Socratic works can little in the way of metaphysical, epistemological, or methodological speculation, and therefore fit well with the way Socrates characterizes himself in Plato's Apology, as a man who leaves investigations of highfalutin matters, matters, which are in the sky and below the earth, to wiser heads, and confines all his investigations to the question of how one should live one life. Aristotle describes Socrates as someone whose interests were restricted to only one branch of philosophy, the realm of the ethical, and he also says that he was in the habit of asking definitional questions to which he himself lacked answers. Metaphysics, sophistical refutations, whatever it is. That testimony gives added weight to the widely accepted hypothesis that there is a group of dialogues one mentions above in his early works, whether or not they are all written early in Plato's writings career, in which Plato used the dialogue form as a way of portraying the philosophical activities of the historical Socrates. Though, of course, he might have used them in other ways as well, for example, to suggest and begin to explore the philosophical difficulties raised by them. But a certain point, so this hypothesis about chronologically of dialogues, so says this hypothesis, Plato began to use his work to advance ideas that were his own creations rather than those of Socrates, although he continued to use the name Socrates as the incubator or actor who presented and argued for these new ideas. The speaker called Socrates now begins to move beyond and apart from the historical Socrates. He has views about the methodologies and should be used by philosophers, a methodology borrowed from mathematics. He argues for the immortality of the soul and the existence and the importance of forms of beauty, justice, goodness, and the like. By contrast, in the Apology, Socrates says, "No one knows what becomes of us after we die." Plato is often said to be the dialogue in which Plato first comes into his own as a philosopher, who is moving far beyond the ideas of his teacher, though it is also commonly said that we see a new methodological sophistication that is, and a greater interest in mathematical knowledge in Meno. Having completed all these, all the dialogues that, according to this hypothesis, we characterize as early, Plato widens the range of his topics to be explored in his writing. in brackets, no longer confine himself to ethics, and place the theory of forms, which is related to ideas about language and knowledge and love, at the center of his thinking. In these works of his middle period, for example, Plato, Critias, Symposium, Republic, and Plautus, there is both a change in emphasis and of doctrine. The focus is no longer on ridding ourselves of false ideas and self-deceit. Rather, we are asked to accept, however tentatively, a radical new conception of ourselves, now divided into three parts, our world, or rather our two worlds, our need to negotiate between them. Definitions are most important virtue term are finally proposed in the Republic. Brackets. The search for them in some of the early dialogues have been unsuccessful. Book one of his dialogue is a portrait of how historical Socrates might have handled the search for definition of justice. And the rest of the dialogue shows how the new ideas, as tools discovered by Plato, can complete the project that is the teacher is unable to finish. Plato continues to use the figure called Socrates as a principal interlocutor. And in this way, he creates a sense of continuity between the methods, insights, and ideas of historical Socrates with the new Socrates, who has now become a vehicle for articulation of his new philosophical outlook. In doing so, he acknowledges his intellectual debt to his teacher and appropriates for his own purposes the extraordinary prestige of a man who is the wisest of his time. Which is rather good. I mean, this will not make sense to people overseas, but people borrow from political predecessors by going back to the same halls and the same settings and then say what the leader says, have photographs of it, and then go on to the next level. So our current Prime Minister is borrowing from a much older Prime Minister of the post-war World War II, 1960s Prime Minister. I don't know why that's so, but this process of taking a form, marketing a form, and then adding some little bit extra into it. Sort of like the Santa Claus, where the Coca-Cola company came in and coloured him to Coca-Cola's company colours and added things to him to sell Coke. And now our view of Santa has got the Coca-Cola view in it. This hypothesis about the chronological of Plato's writing has a third component. It does not place his work in either of two categories, the early Socratic dialogues and all the rest, but the works instead with a threefold division of early, middle, and late. That is because, following ancient testimony, it has become widely accepted assumption that the Laws is one of Plato's last works, and further that his dialogue shares a great many stylistic affinities with a small group of others, Sophist Statements, Timus, Critias, and Philebus. Do you think Philebus is from Filibuster? Oh, wow, I'd love to know if that was true. These five dialogues, together with the Laws, are generally agreed to be his late works because they have much more in common with each other, and when we count certain stylistic features apparently only to readers in Plato's Greek than with any of Plato's other works. Computer accounts have added... How I said before, we should do... It actually says... Computer accounts have added this stylometric studies, but the isolation of this group of six dialogues by the means of their stylistic commonality was recognised in the 19th century. But you can't go past computer analysis of work. So, like I do this with emails, I can actually check who's the author of an email by actually measuring sentence length and structure and objects and stuff like that. But it really, you have to do it. So you can see this is a statement. So here you heard me read this. I haven't read this before, so that was my analysis of how you could do it. So you measure all these, it's called metadata associated with a work, the length of things. And I also got to say that I can't read ancient Greek, but I can read a little bit of Latin. And even though you can read two or three sentences in Latin, then you have to go to Google Translate to make sure you're on the right track. It really does make a huge difference because When it's translated into an understandable form of English. But if you read Livy in the original Latin, which is perhaps the easiest to read or translate, because it's fairly simple, or at least the Latin I've read is fairly simple, you see a great more things. You see things stated there's just a way of seeing it, reading it in the original language. I wish I could describe it. It's like, if you describe something very plain and then say it's ghost, you can get a real feel of their belief in the supernatural as a more common explanation, whereas if we use supernatural terms, we automatically become much more theatric. I just can't really put it into words then. Okay, next paragraph. So they've said, let's crack it with a computer. But you don't really need to do it, says this author. Let's go back to the next paragraph. It's not at all clear whether one or more philosophical affinities amongst the group of six dialogues, that is, whether the philosophy they contain is sharply different from all those of other dialogues. Again, this is just scratching the surface. You can do ring analysis and line analysis between this. It's just so much you could do. Plato does nothing to encourage the reader to view these works as a distinctive and separate components of his thinking. On the contrary, he links Sophists with Theatricus, a conversation they present have largely overlapping casts of characters and take place on successive days. No less than that, Sophists and Statesmen. Sophists contains in its opening pages a reference to the conversation of Polygnes, and perhaps Plato is thus signaling to his readers they should bring to bear on Sophists the lessons that they are drawn from Parmenides. Oh, I don't know. Similarly, Timus opens with the reminder to some of the principal ethical political documents of the Republic. It could be argued, of course, that when one looks beyond the stage-setting devices, one finds significant philosophical changes in the six late dialogues, setting this group off from all that preceded them. But there is no consensus that they should be read in this way. Resolving this issue requires an intensive study of the content of Plato's work. So, although it is widely accepted that the six dialogues mentioned above belong to Plato's latest period, there is, as yet, no agreement amongst the students of Plato that the six forms a distinctive stage in his philosophical development. I don't know, it's sort of like you buy DVDs and you read the actor's comments at the end. It's sort of, it does add, but it also just detracts from it all. My general opinion is that you should just get a sort of mathematical construction of what Plato does, what he uses, when he was, what his devices were, what his central ideas were, and then just launching and read the Republic as a complete set. I think you're overloading, I would expect you're overloading things if you're trying to read all works, given that the human race has moved largely on from, a lot of questions are different. And also, the other thing is that people are reading these views from a misogynistic viewpoint. It was such a dreadful society. They enslaved entire other countries. So Athens was rich by enslaving other peoples. They lived off capturing productive lands of other people and holding people in slavery. It's just incomprehensible, this whole thing about, I really think people are putting their modern views back in time. Okay, continuing the next paragraph. In fact, it remains a matter of dispute whether the division of Plato's works into three periods, early, middle, and late, does correctly indicate the order of composition, and whether it is a useful tool for understanding this thought. Of course, it would be wildly implausible to suppose Plato's writing career began with such complex works as Law, Parmenides, Peres, and Republic. In the light of the widely accepted assumptions of how the most philosophical minds developed, it is likely that when Plato started writing philosophical works, for some of the shorter, simpler dialogues were the ones he composed. Lectures and Sutro and Iron, for example. Similarly, the apologies does not advance a complex philosophical agenda or presuppose an earlier work, body of work. And so, too, is likely to have been composed near the beginning of Plato's writing career. Yeah, it would be nice if you had simplicity, number of characters, you could put, you know, rotate them in a three-dimensional graphics. Even so, there's no good reason to eliminate the hypothesis that throughout much of Plato's life, Plato devoted himself to writing two sorts of dialogues at the same time, moving back and forth between them as he aged. On the one hand, introductory works, whose primary purpose was to show the readers the difficulty of apparently simple philosophical problems, and thereby rid them of their pretensions and false beliefs, and on the other hand, works filled with substantive philosophical theories supported by elaborate argumentations. Now, if I could just say it here, it is the people, the most dangerous people I find. Oh my God, there's another. Oh, I don't believe it. There looks to be yet another bowerbird nest disappear. I just shudder to think what's happening. Okay, so that's just an aside. Here, sitting in an Aussie garden, discussing it to, yeah, by far the worst people. They seem to have a combination of things going for them. Sort of threats. They've got a threat of being cruel, without remorse, and also believing they have understood philosophy. Yep, I got that one. Got that one, mate. Hey, don't talk to me, I understand it all. Moreover, one could point to features of many of the Socratic dialogues that would justify putting them in the latter category, even though the argumentation does not concern metaphysics or methodology or invoke mathematics. Georgias, Protagoras, Lysis, Euthydemus, Hippas Major among them. Okay, well, that's really interesting. I'm glad you're concerned with this problem, mate. Plato makes it clear that both these processes, one preceding the other, must be part of one's philosophical education. One's deepest methodological convictions affirmed by Meno, Theatrus, and Sophist, that in order to make intellectual progress, we must recognize that knowledge cannot be acquired by passively receiving from others. Bucko. No way, bucko. That's just... Rather, we must work our way through the problems and assess the merits of completing theories with an independent mind. Accordingly, some of his dialogues are primarily devices for breaking down the reader's complacencies, and that's why it's essential that they come to no positive conclusions. Others are contributions to theory construction. They are therefore best absorbed by those who have already passed through the first stage of philosophical development. Well, this is one of the key points that surely you must say he's got this content, he's got this device, and he has this process. That's where you are shaken up. It's a bit like training, AFL training. You know, you get a bit of run on the paddock, have a few footballs thrown at you, a bit of rough tackling, and then you get down to working out what you need to do. We should assume that Plato could have written the preparatory dialogues only as the earliest stage of his career, although he may well have begun his writing career by taking up that sort of project, that he may have continued writing these negative works at later stages at the same time he was composing his theory construction dialogues, that is, the negative works, shaking you up, you're on the pack at the start of the season, you're just going for a jog, realizing I am so unfit. Okay, for example, although both Euthydemus and Charmides are widely assumed to be his early dialogues, they might have been written around the same time as Symposium and Republic. Oh, blood oath! Which are generally assumed to be compositions of his middle period or even later. Well, having read the Republic, I think that's easily the most accessible. I've got to reread. I just really wonder whether I have actually only read one section of the Republic, whether I've actually read
someone's long speech, and someone's long, long speech is what I thought was sort of public, which is the parable of the boat. I can't believe it. It's sort of like it's good for Greek time. It makes dreadful telly at the moment. No doubt, some of the works widely considered to be early are such, but it is open to question which and how many of them are. At any rate, it's clear that Plato continued to write in a Socratic and negative vein even after he was well beyond his early stages of career. Theatris features a Socrates who is even more insisted upon his ignorance. The one thing I do know is I know nothing. That are dramatic representations of Socrates in brief, philosophically less complex works that are reasonably assumed to be early, and like many of the early works, Theatris seeks but does not find the answer to what is it? The question which resentfully pursues what is knowledge? Similarly, Parmenides, although certainly not an early dialogue, is a work whose principal aim is to puzzle the reader by the presentation of arguments for apparently contradictory conclusions. The modern reader could not cope with it, I'm sure. If I have something to tell you, and the result is I intend you to go away confused, the majority action nowadays is if you tell something and they go away being confused, they think you're an idiot. They don't think they're idiots. They don't think that anything less of them. They think that you're an idiot. And not that I try and do it, but I think if Plato went today, he'd be just, you know, destroyed by Murdoch's press. Since it does not tell us how it is possible to accept all these conclusions, its principal effect on the reader is similar to that of the dialogues. Many of them, no doubt, early, that reach only negative conclusions. Plato uses this educational advice, provoking the reader through his presentation of opposed arguments. So, yeah, Plato is education, not entertainment, mate. And leaving the contradiction unresolved in Protagoras, which is often considered an early dialogue as well. So it is clear that even after he was well beyond the earliest stages of his thinking, he continued to assign himself the project of writing works whose principal aim is the presentation of unresolved difficulties. And just as we've decided, and it's sort of like you go for an inspection of a lab and you say, these are our products, and these are the products, things which are just absolutely stumping us. The people who don't understand the value of research will just go, oh, I went to the other lab and they discovered less things, but they were absolutely sure of the things they discovered. Okay. And just as we should recognize that puzzling the reader continues to be an aim even in his later works, so too we should not overlook the fact there is some substantive theory construction in ethical works that are simple enough to have been his early compositions. Aeon, Ion, for example, affirms the theory of poetic inspirations, and Crito sets out conditions under which a citizen acquires an obligation to obey civic commands. Neither ends in failure. If we are satisfied, taking Socrates' speeches in Plato's Apology to constitute reliable evidence about the historical Socrates was like, then whatever we find in Plato's other works that is of a piece which the speech can also be safely attributed to Socrates, whatever that sentence is, So understood, Socrates was a moralist, but, unlike Plato, was not a metaphysician, or an epistemologist, or a cosmologist. You stupid nut, Socrates. You just considered right or wrong. You didn't consider all these side things. And this is pretty interesting, because then if you've got Socrates really ethics, Plato a bit more, and then Aristotle completely, and it's sort of in that line light, you can sort of not see them one decaying, you can see that one, they just move from, oh, let's see what they have to read here. Okay. That fits with Aristotle's testimony that Plato This way of choosing a dominant speaker in a dialogue gives further support to the way of distinguishing between him and Socrates. The number of dialogues that are dominated by Socrates, who is spinning out elaborate philosophical doctrines, is remarkably small. Phaedo, Republic, Phaedrus, and Philebus. I really wonder what filibuster is. All of them are dominated by ethical issues, either to fear death, whether to be just, whom to love, to place of the place of pleasure. Evidently, Plato thinks that it is appropriate to make Socrates the major speaker in his dialogue that is filled with positive content only when the topics explored in that work are primarily have to do with ethical life of the individual. The political aspects of Republic are explicitly said to serve a larger question whether any individual, no matter what his circumstances, should be just. When the doctrines he wishes to present systematically become primarily metaphysical, he turns to a visitor, Elam, the sophist, the statesman. And when they become cosmological, he turns to Timus. That's really interesting. And when they come to constitutional in the laws, to a visitor from Athens. And he then eliminates Socrates entirely. In effect, Plato is showing us, although he owes a great deal of ethical insight to Socrates, as well as to his method of puncturing the intellectual pretensions of his interlocutors by leading them into contradiction, he thinks he should not put into the mouth of his teacher too elaborate an exploration of ontological or cosmological or political themes, because Socrates refrained from entering these domains. You would know that Socrates got accused on a philosophical argument and then followed it through by committing suicide with hemlock. It just brain drain. It seems to be the obvious. Yeah, it's a really complex thing in that. Yeah, that's an amazing view. So Socrates committing suicide is the most amazing thing to read and understand. This part of the explanation of why Socrates put into the mouth of the perfanticide laws of Athens the theory advanced by Crito, which reaches the conclusion that it would be unjust for him to escape from prison. And perhaps Plato is indicating at the point where these speakers enter the dialogue that none of what he said there is in any way derived from or inspired by the conversation with Socrates. To be honest, I just don't think Plato was thinking in this advanced, retrospective way. That's my opinion. Just as we should reject the idea that Plato must have made a decision that a fairly early point of his career, no longer to write one kind of dialogue, negative, destructive, or plenary, and to write only works of elaborate theory constructions, so we should also question whether he went through an early stage during which he refrained from introducing into his works any of his own ideas, if he had any, but was content to play the role of a faithful portraitist, representing to his reader the life thought of Socrates. It is, you know what it gives me? It's sort of like, in Australia we had Steve Irwin, who was sort of like a Crocodile Dundee person who used to grab on crocodiles, and then he grabbed one stingray too many, which is, these are these big, flat, gentle beast mantle rays, but they do have a venomous spike which they can pop up, and so if you ride on them with when they really don't like it, they can actually stab you. And they stabbed this person, the Australian Socrates, in the heart, and so we've got a school of Steve Irwin, you know, Australia's Zoo, many years after. So this is a thought that came to mind. It's unrealistic to suppose that someone as original and creative Plato, who probably began to write his dialogues somewhere in his 30s, he's around 28 when Socrates was killed, would have started his compositions with no ideas of his own, or, having such ideas, would have decided to suppress them for some period of time, allowing himself to think for himself only later. What would have led to such a decision? You know what? You could actually put these questions through the Socratic engine and work it out. We should instead treat the moves made in the dialogues, even those that are likely to be early, as Platonic inventions, derived no doubt by Plato's reflections on a transformation of key themes of Socrates that attributes to Socrates in Apology. That speeches indicate, for example, that the kind of regulicity exhibited by Socrates was unorthodox, unlikely to give offence or lead to misunderstanding. It would be implausible to suppose that Plato simply concocted the idea that Socrates followed a divine sign, especially because Xenophon too attributes this to Socrates. So was Socrates one of these hippies, crystal worshipping hippies? I don't know. But what are the various philosophical moves rehearsed in Euthypro, whatever that is, or Blood Oath? Now, my question as well, I was about to ask that. The dialogue in which Socrates searches unsuccessfully for his car keys, no, for an understanding of what piety is, of course. Very practical, Socrates. We have no good reason to think in writing this work, Plato adopted the role of a mere recording device or something close to it. Quote, changing a word here or there, but for the most part simply recalling what he heard Socrates says as he made his way to court. It really is, you can always imagine the old cassette desk. You go around with the reading. It's more likely that Plato, having been inspired by the unorthodoxies of Socrates' conception of piety, developed on his own a series of questions and answers designed to show the readers how difficult it is to reach an understanding of the central concept of Socrates. Fellow citizens relied upon when they condemned him to death. Now, this is interesting because if you actually contain a philosophy in your own head, it becomes overwhelming. But if it's external to you, you can actually work away on little parts of it. It's like doing reno, home reno. It's sort of like reno of your own body. It's sort of a bit overpowering. Okay. And so they condemned Socrates to death. The idea that it is important to search for definitions may have been Socratic in origin. After all, Aristotle attributes this much to Socrates. But the twists and turns of the arguments in Euthypro, and other dialogues that search for definitions are more likely to be products of Plato's mind than the contents of any conversations that really took place. Well, I'm glad you got that sorted out, mate. Okay, well, I'll stitch these two together as a podcast and get going. Thanks a lot for listening. End of episode 3. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.